Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
If you've ever driven by the house you grew up in, or visited the country where your ancestors lived decades or centuries ago, you felt it. Place is powerful, and the best lecture or photograph or documentary in the world can't give you quite the same sense of connecting with the past as physically standing in the place where something happened. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. While our country is younger than many in the world, the U.S. is nevertheless full of places where you can connect with history. It can be as simple as taking a summer road trip. Brent D. Glass is Director Emeritus of the Smithsonian National Museum of American History, and he's just published a book called 50 Great American Places, Essential Historic Sites Across the U.S. He's in town to speak tonight at the Sixth Floor Museum in Dallas. Brent, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
One thing I love about this book is that it's more than battlefields and political history. It can be easy to overlook the fact that regular people are as much a part of American history as the ones whose names we're taught to memorize.
Well, I'm interested in historical literacy. And by that, I mean why places and people and events are important and why they're essential to understanding American history. And that involves extraordinary places like battlefields, but it also involves some of the ordinary places like you mentioned. And so a place, let's say the Presidio in San Francisco, is an extraordinary place on the one hand, and yet so much everyday history happened there and in that general area, in the Bay Area. So I had a mix of ideas and themes that I wanted to include in the book. And I had five major themes that I think reflect and shape American identity. One is freedom, the story of freedom. Second, war, the impact of war. Innovation is third. Diversity is fourth. And land, the impact of the landscape, was fifth. And I think those five themes help us understand what it means to be an American, and helps us understand a great deal about who we are as Americans and an American identity. And as you said, it's a young country, but yet there's so much complexity in our history, and it goes beyond political and military, and includes technological history and social and cultural history. So I tried to select a number of places that reflected all of those themes.
I hadn't thought much before about the relationship between the Presidio in San Francisco and the battle for the Republic of Texas.
Well, I think the connection would be the expansion of the United States was occurring in the 1830s and 1840s. Presidio was the northernmost outpost of the Spanish Empire, and actually the first Spanish fort at what became San Francisco was built in 1776, at the same time as the colonists on the East Coast were declaring independence from Great Britain. And the Alamo was also part of that Spanish Empire and that effort to control the eastern border of New Spain. And so I deliberately chose several sites that reflected in the Southwest the fact that America started in several places, in the Southwest with the Spanish, in the East with the English settlement. And then there were some important French settlements along the Mississippi River, such as St. Louis and New Orleans, that remind us that this country has developed in different ways at different times and sometimes at the same time. So it's not only an east to west migration that often we think about when we're taught history in school.
Most people listening to this program probably have been to the Alamo. Lots of school kids are taken there, and people take weekend trips to San Antonio. And people always comment the first time on how small it looks.
Yes.
For me, that really drove home how terrifying it must have been to be in this not incredibly secure place,
yes,
knowing that a huge force was up against you.
It's an amazing story. It's one of those extraordinary stories that is still so inspirational and compelling and scary, as you said. And yet it led to eventual independence of the Republic of Texas, and then eventually Texas becoming part of the Union. I think the story of the Alamo is significant as well, most recently, the fact that the World Heritage designation, World Heritage Site designation, has been approved for the other missions that are in San Antonio, the Spanish missions. And there are, I think, five altogether, including the Alamo. And the other four are not as well known, but they have survived in one form or another. Some are in better shape than others. But the National Park Service is involved in managing and interpreting those other mission sites. And it's also worthwhile mentioning this is the centennial of the National Park Service. And the Presidio and the missions in San Antonio and something like 400 other places in this country are managed by the National Park Service. Many of them are historic sites. And about half of the historic sites in my book are units of the National Park Service.
Something else that I really loved about the book was that you do start American history long before the English colonists were battling it out on the East Coast. You know, having grown up along the border, people there are very much aware that there were Europeans who settled the Southwest and built these beautiful missions. And there's a gorgeous church still standing in Tucson.
Yes, the Mission San Javier del Bac, which was never completed, but the last construction stopped in 1797. And the church is still part of the diocese. It's still an operating church on a American Indian reservation. But the interior of the church is spectacular. It is unchanged. It's more than 200 years old. And there are hand-carved wooden statues of the Virgin Mary, of the various saints, of anonymous American Indians. We don't actually know who did all the artwork, but it is one of the most incredible interiors of a church you'll see anywhere. And it's right here in the U.S., as you say, just outside of Tucson.
This may be too metaphysical a question for a professional historian, but do you think that there's some kind of energy that remains in places steeped in history?
I definitely believe that. I have experienced that the power of place many times at a place like Mission San Javier, as you mentioned, on the battlefield at Gettysburg in particular, even though there are 1,300 memorials and monuments on the battlefield now. I still have a feeling of awe and terror, I guess, in imagining what it was like during those 3 days of intense battle at Gettysburg. And then to go to the National Cemetery at Gettysburg and think about Abraham Lincoln delivering the Gettysburg Address in November of 1863 and how powerful that must have been to be standing there and hear those words that redefined the meaning of the Civil War. He starts out by talking about the war being a war to preserve the Union, and he ends the speech just a few minutes later saying, "This nation will have a new birth of freedom," meaning the abolition of slavery. And so that's an incredible place to we can read about it, but when you're standing at that place, to me, the authenticity of the place, the fact that it's been preserved is very meaningful. And let me just add that another reason for writing the book was to acknowledge the fact that how much we have preserved in our country. In spite of the fact that we are a progressive country and we're always building and tearing down, there are some people who had the vision and the perseverance to say we need to save some of these places forever. And that, I think, is an important legacy that we should talk about.
I have been to St. Louis, so of course I've been to the St. Louis Arch, because you almost can't go there without checking out the arch. But nobody told me to go take a look at the mound at Cahokia.
I think that's another place that should be on everyone's list, especially when you climb to the top of Monk's Mound, the tallest mound, and it's 154 steps, I counted. And on a clear day, you can look across the river and see the arch. And when you're at the top of the arch, you can look out and I believe you can see the Cahokia Mounds. Cahokia was in the 13th century as large and maybe even a little larger than the city of London at the same time. This was a remarkable culture of very innovative, for the in spite of the fact that they had no advanced technology. They had no horses to carry the mounds of dirt that they had to transport to build these mounds. But they were very sophisticated, and I think it's important to realize that we think about American Indians as nomadic, as not being settled. But here was a settlement of more than 10,000 people, and probably another 10,000 living in the outlying areas. And they traded up and down the Mississippi Valley, and so you find evidence of mound building and evidence of the Cahokia civilization all over the central part of the country.
What was the significance of the mounds themselves?
They had several functions. They were ceremonial. They were burial mounds. They were boundary markers. They were residences for the priests. Actually, there were residences at the top of Monk's Mound, for example. So they had several different functions.
What can you tell us about the challenges of preserving sites like that where, you know, in modern times they are essentially sited, you know, with a lot of really expensive real estate around them?
Yes. Well, I think the Cahokia Mounds is a great example of sites that are still threatened because there's highway construction going on, there's new housing developments, and not all the mounds are protected. And I know in East St. Louis, for example, there are several mounds that are threatened right at this time. Fortunately, the state of Illinois acquired the most significant examples of the mounds and have that in a state park. And that is probably – public ownership is probably the most likely way of preserving some of our sites. On the other hand, there are some sites that are functional and still used. Grand Central Terminal is one that I'm particularly fond of, and I was there this week because I was in New York and never ceased to marvel at the blend of functionality and just aesthetic wonder. And I like to quote Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, who was an advocate for the preservation of the Grand Central Terminal when it was threatened with development in the 1970s. And she said, I think I've got this right, how will – if we fail to inspire our children with the importance of the past, how will they have the strength to fight for the future? And I thought that was just captures to me the essence of why preserving history is so important.
It makes me think about, you know, also in New York, there's a place called Madison Square Garden, which doesn't look like Madison Square and it doesn't look like a garden anymore.
No.
It's a arena.
It's an arena, and it happens to be on top of Penn Station. And when Penn Station was demolished in the 1960s, Penn Station and Grand Central Terminal were developed about the same time in the first decade of the 20th century. The demolition of Penn Station is what triggered the modern historic preservation movement as we know it today. And when it was time to – when there was a proposal to develop a skyscraper over Grand Central Terminal – the advocates for preservation said, we don't want this to happen again in our city. And that preservation of Grand Central led to an important Supreme Court decision. For the first time, a landmark commission, a legislation setting up a landmark commission was upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court as being a legitimate function of government to preserve our past.
We're speaking this hour with Brent D. Glass. He's Director Emeritus at the Smithsonian National Museum of American History and author of 50 Great American Places, Essential Historic Sites Across the U.S. He's in town to speak tonight at the Sixth Floor Museum in Dallas. If you would like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with the Director Emeritus of the Smithsonian National Museum of American History, Brent D. Glass. His new book is 50 Great American Places, Essential Historic Sites Across the U.S. Tonight, in partnership with the Frontiers of Flight Museum and the Dallas Holocaust Museum, he will be speaking at the 6th Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza in Dallas. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, maybe ask a question about a place you have wanted to visit in the United States of historic significance, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The crew of this show was in Washington, D.C. last month, and we visited the National Mall, which is always a fascinating sight. How did Americans come to believe that we needed this really grand space to kind of demonstrate our emergence as a global political and economic power?
The idea for the National Mall was in the original plan, L'Enfant's plan for Washington, D.C., but it didn't really take shape until the late 19th century and the early 20th century. And that coincided with America's emergence as a world power. And America, after the Civil War, began to think of itself as a unified nation and as a nation on the world stage. And it's not a coincidence that the National Mall began to become more formally designed and developed as part of that national character. And there was a congressional commission with some of the leading architects and landscape designers in the country in the early 20th century, the Macmillan Commission, that actually laid out a formal standard and formal guidelines. And it's so impressive now to, as you say, stand on the National Mall and think about the landmarks of democracy, the Capitol, the White House, the Supreme Court not far off the mall, and all the memorials and museums that together give us a sense of national pride and national identity. And it's a living monument. There are demonstrations that have taken place there and continue to take place. There are concerts. There is the folk festival that the Smithsonian sponsors every year. So it's not a static place. It's a dynamic place. And I think it reflects the dynamic quality of democracy in the 21st century.
A lot of people have been drawn to the Vietnam War Memorial because you can still see people who have experience with the war, who know some of the names that are listed on the wall. One that I think gets overlooked is the Korean War Memorial,
yes,
which is very moving because it's not only there are still some veterans who may have served in that war, but there are a lot of Korean Americans and Korean nationals visiting the United States who connect to it in a really different way.
Yes, I agree with you. I think both memorials are very different. And they tell different stories. And in the case of the Korean War, it's a war which had no winner or loser. We're still, in effect, an occupier.
A ceasefire, right?
And a ceasefire never formally ended the war. In the case of the Vietnam War, we acknowledge that we lost that war. And there are very few countries in the world that would do a memorial that visible and of such a visible space to acknowledge the fact that we have tragedies and defeats in our country's history. And I think that's one of the great things about being a historian, a public historian in the United States, is that we are free to argue about our history, to talk about some of the challenges. And I try to incorporate that in 50 Great American Places. So it's not a celebration in the sense that, yes, we're very proud of the National Mall. We're proud of our victories in battle and our technological, extraordinary technological achievements. But I also include places that have a darker story. The massacre at Wounded Knee, for example, is included in the book. The internment camp at Minidoka in Idaho. The witch trial memorial in Salem, Massachusetts, which is another story of social unrest and discontent. So I think that's what's so rich about American history is that we have this variety, and we can explore that by visiting these places.
Is it possible to experience Salem, Massachusetts without all the kitsch?
I think so. Mm-hmm. I think you have to search and you have to be determined not to get bogged down in some of the, as you say, kitsch or some of the making fun of witches and things like that, because it's a very serious story.
Yeah.
And I think the fact that we're having a revival now of The Crucible by Arthur Miller is a very popular play in New York and is making the rounds around the country. This was a moment at which the age of faith was giving way to the age of enlightenment, and you really can understand the tensions in colonial society by looking more carefully at the witch trials. And the witch trials involved not only women, but involved many men as well, who were executed during that 1 year of 1692. So I think you can explore that subject in Salem, and there's many other stories in Salem that are quite interesting. The House of Seven Gables is there. There's a wonderful maritime historic site managed by the National Park Service. And the Peabody Essex Museum is one of the best history museums in the country, and I strongly recommend a visit there. I know you said you might be going to that area this summer, and I recommend a side trip to Salem.
Oh, that's great. Well, another thing that I know in that part of the country that is kind of a perfect tour of history is the Freedom Trail.
Yes.
2.5 miles, and how many historic sites are along those 2.5 miles?
There are 16 sites along the Freedom Trail, so I call the book 50 Great American Places, but I get many extra places in some of the essays. So the Freedom Trail includes 16 sites and some of the major events that led to the American Revolution are preserved along the Freedom Trail. The Old South Meeting House, the Old State House, Paul Revere's home. Some of the key moments that help us understand how we became in the position of declaring independence from Great Britain are told at along the Freedom Trail. And in addition, there are a few very interesting memorials from later wars. The USS Constitution is there from the War of 1812. And then the Shaw Memorial across from the Massachusetts State House, which was a memorial to the 54th Massachusetts, the African-American unit that served during the Civil War and whose story is told in the great movie Glory. And that memorial is designed by Augustus St. Gaudens, and that is also connected to the Freedom Trail.
How did upstate New York become such an important site for the women's movement?
Yeah. Well, upstate New York, especially after the completion of the Erie Canal in 1825, that area of New York attracted economic activity and also cultural institutions and political reform ideas and religious organizations that moved into that area. Some religious groups started in that general area. The Latter-day Saints, for example, started in upstate New York. But along the Erie Canal, there were several industrial towns, Seneca Falls being one of them. And I find it very remarkable that Elizabeth Cady Stanton and her friend Lucretia Mott, who was visiting from Philadelphia at that time in July of 1848. They were meeting for tea at Lucretia Mott's sister's home, and they had known each other for several years, and I won't go into that story, which is also another great story, but they decided, you know, it's time. We're abolitionists. We're against slavery. We're for progressive reform, but we need to do something about women's rights. And on 3 weeks' notice, they decide they're going to have a convention. And they send out the word. There's no fax machines at that time. There's no internet. There's no telephone. They had the telegraph, but they got – 3 weeks later, they hold a convention in Seneca Falls, and 300 people come. And they draft a document called the Declaration of Sentiments. And it was modeled on the Declaration of Independence. But there was one clause in that declaration that said women should have the right to vote. And it's hard for us to imagine how revolutionary that idea was at that time. And it took 70 years, almost 70 years, for that idea to become part of our constitutional law. But that started there at Seneca Falls. And today you can visit the National Park Historic Site administered by the Park Service and learn that story about Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Her home is part of that complex as well, or it's a few blocks away in Seneca Falls. And a few miles from Seneca Falls is the town of Auburn, New York, where Harriet Tubman lived the last 50 years of her life. And she lived on land that she purchased from William Seward, who was Abraham Lincoln's Secretary of State. So I enjoy finding these connections between these different places. So it's not only what happened, but why it happened at certain times. And history is not inevitable. It doesn't just happen and as we read about it in a book and say, well, of course there was the Underground Railroad, or of course there was the Women's Rights Convention. It happened because people made choices, and sometimes very courageous choices to change society.
I think that's a great point. And when you look at the women's movement and the push for the right to vote, today it's self-evident not only that women deserve the right to vote, but that we want the right to vote. And there was some convincing that people in the women's movement early on had to do of other women.
Yes. Exactly. I think that the role, what was the proper role, and trying to define a woman's role in society as a political entity, as a political, the political identity of women, took some time to understand. And the fact that the equality was measured in the right to have access to the ballot and to run for office. And to hold office and to hold property. And so all these rights that we now take for granted were discussed in great detail. In fact, there were the Grimke sisters from South Carolina were criticized for talking to mixed audiences. And I'm not talking about mixed audiences of racial mixture. I'm talking about men and women. It was even considered radical for men and women to sit together in an audience. So I think we have to look at these episodes and these milestones in American history and try to dig a little deeper. And that's what I tried to do in 50 Great American Places, even though each essay is only about 1,000 words. I think and I have an introduction to each site, and I hope it encourages people to drill more deeply into some of these stories.
You mentioned the start of the Mormon Church, and of course they got bounced around the country. They were persecuted in many cases.
Yes.
I hadn't realized that tours of the Mormon Temple in Salt Lake City are open to the public for most sections of the facility.
Not of the temple itself, of all the other buildings. Okay. There are several buildings in that complex mm-hmm. at Temple Square, and I think the story of the Mormon Church of the Latter-day Saints is such a unique American story, and it's one of the few religions, and maybe the only religion in the world that has its story of origin that takes place in America. And so I think that sets it apart in many ways from many other religions. I think a visit to the Temple Square in Salt Lake City is quite impressive and an important part of an essential part of understanding American history.
Monticello is another place that is really key to understanding American history. And it really it puts us squarely in the face of this conflict we have with Thomas Jefferson.
Yes.
Right. You see on display his extraordinary curiosity and his kind of Renaissance mind brain. On the other hand, you cannot escape the fact that the place was built and maintained by never less than 130 people kept in slavery just to keep the place running.
Yes. One of the challenges as a historian we have of not committing the sin of presentism, I guess, and trying to judge the actors in history by our standards rather than the standards of their own time. Now, Jefferson is an exception because he was the one who wrote the Declaration of Independence. So he wrote the words, all men are created equal. So he held himself, I think, we have to hold him to a higher standard, perhaps, although a number of my colleagues at Monticello always advise me to understand the times in which Jefferson lived and a little bit more about how complex a man he was. There's a recent book just that came out in the last few few weeks, trying to examine Jefferson's motivations, his psychology, his emotional life. So he is one of those figures who I think we're going to be reading about and arguing about perhaps for many years. It's interesting to me that Alexander Hamilton now has had a resurgence in interest because of the successful hit show on Broadway. But it does illustrate to me that we can make history interesting to people by using some of the tools of entertainment and still do a very credible job. I saw the play Hamilton in November, and I was very impressed with the accuracy and the complexity of that presentation.
Was there anything that was left out or added in that you weren't crazy about?
I think the show elevates Hamilton in certain areas, especially his military record. Many historians, and I went back to the record after seeing the show because I didn't remember, because I include Yorktown in the book, the Battle of Yorktown. And I didn't remember many accounts that I read talking very much about Hamilton. But yet in the show, he is given quite a bit of credit of leading a major offensive at the very end of the siege of Yorktown, and that show may have exaggerated a little bit there. I was sorry that they left out Hamilton's contributions to economic development. He was one of the first advocates for industrial development, and Paterson, New Jersey, was where the one of the early industrial developments occurred with his encouragement, and now that has become a national park site. And perhaps we'll learn that story a little bit more completely as the National Park Service develops that site in Paterson, New Jersey.
We're speaking this hour with Brent D. Glass, Director Emeritus of the Smithsonian National Museum of American History and author of 50 Great American Places, Essential Historic Sites Across the U.S. He's in town to speak tonight at the Sixth Floor Museum in Dallas. If you would like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with the Director Emeritus of the Smithsonian National Museum of American History, Brent D. Glass. His new book is 50 Great American Places, Essential Historic Sites Across the U.S. You can contact us via email to think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Jerry, who writes, "Every summer I take a road trip from Memphis to western Colorado. Every year we take a different route and take our time getting there. We have followed Route 66, the Santa Fe Trail, the Trail of Tears, and discovered history and characters one would never find if we just took the interstate. Apps like TripAdvisor are great for finding odd and little-known places and museums."
Well, I agree. I think to get off the interstate and to places like Route 66, which I write about in 50 Great American Places, which was also called the Will Rogers Highway after Will Rogers was killed in a plane crash in 1936. It was also called the Mother Road by John Steinbeck in Grapes of Wrath, and was one of the first of the interstate highways before we formally had the interstate highway system in the 1950s. As early as the 1920s, there was the recognition that the automobile was going to be the shaping technology of the 20th century, as the railroad was in the 19th century. And so I agree, getting off the interstates and onto some of these side roads is a great way to explore American history.
What can we learn about the history of American innovation in Menlo Park?
Thomas Edison was the most prolific inventor in American history, and he still holds the most patents, over 1,000 patents. And what we learn about at Menlo Park was how he put together a research and development enterprise, the first of its kind.
He was not a lone genius.
That's right. He had scientists and engineers and skilled fabricators who worked with him. He was a genius in many ways, and he was self-taught to a large extent. But he had he recognized that if he brought together teams of people to work on some of his ideas, he would be more successful. And I think another National Park Service site in West Orange, New Jersey, Edison's Laboratory, gives you a wonderful window into just how successful and sometimes how not successful Edison was. But one of the favorite places at that site for me is a building that Edison called the Black Mariah. And it's a reconstruction of his movie studio where he pioneered in the making of motion pictures. And it's designed in such a way that it's on a turntable and has a retractable roof so he could control light and capture some dramatic scenes when he was making some of his early movies in West Orange, New Jersey.
And one might have thought that the film industry would end up there, but instead it went to Southern California.
Went to Southern California, and the Warner Brothers studio is one of the 50 great American places. And another story of innovation and enterprise, probably the most – what I was impressed most with about the Warner Brothers contributions to motion pictures. One was the invention of sound movies. Mm-hmm. That the Jazz Singer was a Warner Brothers invention or contribution.
The Al Jolson version, Neil Diamond version.
That's right. when you read about that, that took quite a bit of trial and error to develop the technology so that when we watch a movie and see someone singing or speaking. That's done in a way that's seamless and takes quite a bit of technological know-how. And the second impressive fact that I learned about the Warner Brothers studio and their contribution to motion pictures was they in the 1930s they took on some controversial subjects. They made movies about unionism, for example. They made movies about the rise of fascism. And one of their movies, they made movies about the Ku Klux Klan. And one of their movies, Confessions of a Nazi Spy, came out just as World War II was starting in Europe and caused quite a stir. And several countries in Europe refused to show the film. It was quite controversial. So we think of the early years of motion pictures, and most studios took a safe route and avoided some controversial subjects. Warner Brothers took on some fairly notable social and political issues.
You may have seen when you came in from the airport, you'll certainly see it tonight when you're at the Sixth Floor Museum. There's a very tall building in downtown Dallas with a ball on the top, and that's Reunion Tower, named for a utopian colony in the 19th century. You write about a couple that were in Indiana.
Yes. I was in New Harmony, Indiana last week talking about the book. And the Harmonist Society was the first utopian society to settle in New Harmony. They had been in Pennsylvania in the first decade of the 19th century and named their town Harmony. And then they moved out to New Harmony, Indiana. And then in the 1820s, they decided to move back to Pennsylvania and sold their land to another communal enterprise, Robert Owen, who was an industrialist from Scotland, and he was not advocating a religious society, so he had a very different model. The Harmonists were extremely successful, probably one of the most successful communal societies in our country,
because they often don't last.
No, and they lasted for quite a while. They were very industrious. They were manufacturers. A number of their products won awards. They had museums. They collected. They were extraordinary. They were celibate, however, and so they didn't have a very strong succession plan. And so eventually, by the end of the 19th century, they had died out. Robert Owen's experiment in communal living was not successful, but he had brought so many interesting philosophers and scientists and educators to that part of Indiana that their impact lasted for many years and continues to be reflected today in the museum and historic site that is privately managed by the University of Southern Indiana in partnership with Historic New Harmony.
I remember as a college student being essentially dragged to the Hoover Dam, traveling with a friend and his parents over the summer, and it was incredibly impressive. You don't think before, you can see it in pictures and it doesn't look like nearly as much as it does when you see it for yourself.
I think the relevance of Hoover Dam today is that the problems of water in that part of the country is very evident today. And the Hoover Dam was built with the idea that we could control and manage the Colorado River and try to use that water for irrigation, for flood control, for recreation, for hydroelectric power. And for many years, that was the first of many of several dams that were built in the West. And now we're finding that we don't have enough water. And there's a fair amount of revisionism at work now among historians and public policy thinkers about how we can solve our problems of just providing enough water for the growing population in that part of the country. But you're correct. Hoover Dam as a technological wonder is must be seen. And I'm impressed at how they also, the designers, incorporated some works of art and sculpture for visitors to experience and enjoy alongside of this amazing technological achievement.
Was there any hesitation to go ahead and name it after one of the least regarded presidents of the 20th century?
Well, it's interesting that when Franklin Delano Roosevelt dedicated the dam in 1935, he did not mention President Hoover at all and refused to call it the Hoover Dam. They called it the Boulder Dam, because it's located in the Black Canyon, but there was the Boulder Canyon where it originally was supposed to be located. That's another long story. But not until 1947 did Congress officially name the dam the Hoover Dam. And the reason it was named for Hoover was the work he did. He was an engineer, and he had led the effort to work out a compromise among the seven states that were drained by the Colorado River. And that compact led to a division of water rights among those states. And he was given credit for coming up with that plan. So it was mostly for his work as an engineer and as Secretary of Commerce, but also as president, he saw that the funding for the Hoover Dam was protected and continued the allocation.
You mentioned Yellowstone earlier in the interview, and of course it's getting a lot of attention now because the National Park Service is celebrating its centennial. What are the arguments for thinking of Yellowstone as a historic site as well as a site for natural conservation?
Because it was the first national park and predates the National Park Service by, I guess, 40 years, Yellowstone represents innovation in policy. And the United States was the first country in the world to say that the federal government had one of the functions was to protect rare and beautiful landscapes. And as I mentioned, the land is one of those shaping themes of American history. And Yellowstone helps us understand that while we are a progressive country and a country where economic development is very very high priority, preservation of not only of history but of natural and scenic beauty is part of our legacy as well. And Yellowstone in particular, because of the unique scientific specimens that are there, and the geysers and the and those features that are so unusual, I think bears a special noteworthy.
Everybody in America knows the Statue of Liberty, whether or not they've actually been to Ellis Island. I was really interested to read that the symbolism we ascribe to it today is very different than the intention when it was given to the United States by France and installed in 1884.
There are many sites in 50 great American places that end up being different than they were. Mm-hmm. And the Statue of Liberty is a very good example. When the French wanted to acknowledge and had the idea for the Statue of Liberty, they wanted to acknowledge the preservation of the American Union at the end of the Civil War. So the idea for the Statue of Liberty came about in the late 1860s and took a number of years to finally be accomplished. But if you look at the statue at on the ankle of the Statue of Liberty, there's a chain that's broken. And that represented the end of slavery. And that was the original intent. However, by the time the statue was dedicated in 1886, the immigration to the United States was increasing in great numbers. And the statue came to represent something different than the preservation of the Union. And the famous poem by Emma Lazarus, "Give us your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free," which is now a plaque affixed to the statue, actually wasn't placed on the statue until several years after it was dedicated. So its symbolism grew over time and is very different than what it started out to be in the 1860s when the idea first came about in France.
You have Henry Ford's facility on this list as well. And you note he didn't invent the automobile, but he might as well have in some ways.
He perfected the assembly line mm-hmm. and the idea of mass producing the automobile. And the first assembly line, I believe, was 1908. And then later he advanced technology to the point where he was the most productive car manufacturer in the country. So he perfected the assembly of automobiles. And then he also innovated in being the first industrialist to pay his workers enough money so they could buy automobiles and really created a middle class, an American what previously had been working class. So he was an innovator in many respects. And Ford River Rouge, which I write about in the book, was completed at the end of the 1920s, and it became the symbol of modern technology. And during World War II, it was part of what we call now the arsenal of democracy. And so it has significance on several levels.
Brent D. Glass is Director Emeritus of the Smithsonian Museum of American History and author of 50 Great American Places, Essential Historic Sites Across the U.S. He will be speaking tonight at the 6th Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza in Dallas. Brent, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you for making time for us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Samantha Guzman is associate producer with help on the phones today from Alex Smith. And our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.